Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm your host, Yaakov Katz, and you can find us on a variety of podcast platforms, Google Play, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. This week has been exciting. Israel is reopening. We can go to the gym, to restaurants, and most important for the parents among us, all grades are back in school. Thank God. The vaccine rollout continues. Israel inoculated its 5th million person this week, and we remain at a pace of about 100,000 jabs a day. People getting their first dose, and other people getting their second. But we remain in a bit of a weird state. We're opening, some might say, leading the world in that sense, but we're stuck in political deadlock. One day a poll shows Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with enough seats to establish what he calls the true right-wing government. But the next day another poll shows that he doesn't have enough seats, but also that the other side, the so-called anti-Bibi camp, also not having enough. We have an exciting show today. I'll start speaking with two of our veteran reporters who have been both writing for the Jerusalem Post for the last 20-plus years, Gil Hoffman, our longtime political analyst, and Khaled Abu Tawameh, our Palestinian affairs correspondent. Gil and I will then chat a bit with David Fine, founder of a movement called Anglovision, to create something of an Anglo-political bloc in Israel. I, for one, am a bit skeptical. And to finish us off, we'll hear from Laha Varkov's fascinating interview this week with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Here we go. Gil, let's start with you. Where are we right now when it comes to the political situation? What should we expect to see over the next 2 weeks?
We're currently in a deadlock in which all the leading players are desperately trying to bring up their amount of seats by even one or two, which could end that deadlock and allow there to be an outcome in the March 23rd election that would allow a government to be formed. You've got the pro-Netanyahu bloc and the anti-Netanyahu bloc desperately trying to get that extra seat. And that's why the turnout of Israeli Arabs, for instance, could make all the difference.
So we're going to talk about that. I want to get Khaled's input. But you wrote a story the other day, interesting, about all these American advisors who are sticking their hand into the Israeli political pot. What can you tell us? How many are there? Who are they? Why are they here? Why do Israelis think that over there it's better than the advisors who are here? What's the story behind it all?
It all started in 1996 when Netanyahu brought Arthur Finkelstein, the renowned Republican strategist, to Israel, and he won an election that nobody thought that could be won. Netanyahu was facing off against Shimon Peres right after there had been assassination that Netanyahu was blamed for, rightly or wrongly, with incitement that led to it. And so no one thought that Rabin's successor could lose. And after they saw that that worked, everybody wanted one. It became a symbol of status.
The new toy.
Exactly, to have an American strategist. And so then it would Barack have
well, it sounds one. It sounds good the way you said it, an American strategist.
Yeah. Benny Gantz had one last time, and so now we're up to four. Four parties say that they're running for prime minister. In order to run for prime minister, you need to have a few different things in Israel. You have to have a good lawyer, a private investigator, and an American strategist.
Uh-huh. Well, that's the holy trinity, I guess, for Israeli politics. Khaled, you've covered for many years the Palestinian Authority. But before, I want to ask you more about the Israeli elections. But before that, has Abu Mazen ever hired an American strategist for his elections? Although, well, there haven't been elections in a long time, right?
He doesn't really need a strategist or an advisor because we only had one presidential election. That was in 2005, and since then there are no elections. This whole idea of hiring consultants and advisors does not exist really in Palestinian electoral systems, and not even in the Arab world. We don't hear about it because it's a different culture, different mentality, and different rules over there. You can't hire someone from outside to help you win an election, because that's seen as meddling in the internal affairs of the Arabs, so they try to avoid it. The last thing Abu Mazen would want is to be seen as, consulting with someone who's not Palestinian or someone who...
And then could be accused of being a puppet of sorts, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, right. Especially if this guy is an American or a European. He's already facing such allegations of being a puppet in the hands of the Israelis, the Americans, the Europeans. So that's the last thing he needs.
Well, maybe they should switch it up, and we'll talk a little further on about the upcoming Palestinian elections. But before that, you know, what's interesting is the other day we saw Netanyahu go down south, right? He claims to have visited Rahat, a Bedouin city. The mayor says he wasn't actually in the city. He was in the outskirts of the city. Okay, put that aside. He went and sat in a Bedouin tent with a bunch of these Bedouin tribal chiefs. Personally, I was wondering if, you know, besides the coffee, if they passed around something else, maybe a little more illegal like hashish, but, you know, we'll put that aside for a moment. But what is he doing this time? And he's obviously reaching out to the Arab vote in an unprecedented way by a Likud leader. And that's changing the voting patterns of Arabs, right?
Absolutely. I think that Netanyahu is being very clever. He sees a vacuum that needs to be filled. He sees a crisis of leadership in the Arab sector. He sees a growing disillusionment among the Arab Israelis with their Knesset members. He sees the joint list, which is a coalition of four Arab parties, split. And he sees an opportunity. For the first time, he sees that the Arabs are searching for a new home, for new parties to vote for. And he is coming into that vacuum, trying to fill it. I don't rule out the possibility that he might get one or two seats in the Arab sector. I do see some people among the Arab Israelis who are saying, well, what has the joint list done for us? What have our Arab Knesset members done for us? Maybe it's time for us not to boycott the establishment. Maybe Netanyahu, Abu Yair.
If you can't beat them, join them.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. This is a very interesting phenomenon. We haven't had this for many years. And that's why I think Netanyahu is very clever his attempts to court to win the support of the Arab sector. Right. I'm not saying that all the Arabs are going to vote for Likud or for Abu Yair Netanyahu tomorrow morning. But
Abu Yair, because he is the father of Yair,
yes,
right?
And
that's how
that's like a nickname,
right?
In Arab society, you're called a father is called after his elder son. And if his elder son is Yair, then he's Abu Yair, the father of Yair. That's a kind of a kavod, a kind of honor to call someone, you know, oh, he has a son. So
even if your son is a very vulgar tweeter, it doesn't make a difference.
You will always carry the name of your elder son. And if you don't have a son, and you don't have sons at all, they make up a name. And attach it to you. They can make up, but it has to be a male. Why? Because he's a father who has males, you know, not only girls.
Right.
Well, that's a cultural thing.
Got it.
But anyway.
But you think that this has the potential to change the map.
So, don't forget that the Arab sector is facing many problems, an upsurge in crime.
Right. Poor infrastructure, education.
Poor infrastructure, education. Now they have a health problem with the upsurge in the number of coronavirus infections. The Arabs in Israel are looking for a savior. And here is Netanyahu coming and telling them, I'm your savior. Let's forget about the past. Let's forget about all the bad things I said about you. You know, Arabs rushing to the ballot boxes.
Back in 2015.
And some Arabs seemed willing to forgive him for that.
So Gil, I want to ask you, you know, Netanyahu has also launched his kind of what's known as the Gewalt campaign, right? Where he says, Gewalt, I might lose the election, vote for me, pretty early on at this time. He's doing a ton of media interviews. He's going to the Arab, he's sitting in Bedouin tents. But these are things he does not do, right? He never does these kind of things. Is this something that we should see as a sign of pressure that he thinks he really might lose this time? Or is that what he wants us to believe?
The more he could persuade right-wing voters that his reign is in jeopardy, the better it is for him. That's what's worked for him time and time again. And so Yair Lapid getting that number 20 above 19, that makes a huge difference in the eyes of the right-wing voters, that maybe Yair Lapid could really come to power. And so he goes to the Arab sector. I don't think the goal is really to get Arab votes. If anything, it's to confuse the Arab population, keep them at home. The fewer votes that there are for Arab parties, the easier it is for anyone to form a government, because the Arab parties traditionally don't join governments. And the more seats there are that are not Arab, the more likely that we could get to number 61. And so that's why we've seen Netanyahu's strategy. We've seen also other parties that are Zionist. I think what's happening in Meretz is fascinating. We interviewed the number four candidate in Meretz, who's an Arab woman. They have Arabs at number four and number five on their list. And why are they not crossing the electoral threshold in the polls? It's something actually I wanted to ask Khaled about that's fascinating. Number one on the Meretz list is Nitzan Horovitz, who is gay. Right. The polls of the Israel Democracy Institute, every year, they ask Israelis, who do you least want to have as your neighbor? It gives a bunch of minority groups. Among his regular Israeli Jews, the people they want to have as a neighbor least, ultra-Orthodox. They'd rather have Arab neighbors than ultra-Orthodox. Among Arabs, number one, every year, gays. What is it about gays that Arabs are
so... Well, I think they're very conservative society. You know, is that what it is?
This could decide the election.
Absolutely, but let me disagree with you. I don't think that the issue of Nitzan, what's his name,
Horovitz
being gay is really a factor over here. I think the Arabs abandoned Meretz a long time ago. They just don't feel that Meretz represents them. They're saying this is a Zionist party. We voted in the past for Meretz, and in the last elections, Meretz did not even have an Arab on its list. So they've lost faith in Meretz. What I do see right now among the Arab Israelis is a trend, say that, or a new approach that says we want to be part of the establishment. We do want to be part of a coalition. It doesn't matter if it's a right wing, left wing, because we're fed up with being in the opposition all the time. And that's the new approach that Mansour Abbas brought, which says, look...
Who's the head of the Ra'am faction, yes, which has broken off from the joint list and is running on its own. So far, not exactly crossing the threshold.
Absolutely, but he's not the only one. There's a new party called Ma'an, headed by Mohammad Darawshi, that is also saying, look, we are running in the election because we want to be part of the coalition. We're telling you right now, we are fed up of being in opposition to the opposition. We are fed up of being marginalized, and we want to be part of the decision-making process. And that's what's new in the Arab sector. We didn't have this before. Now, all these images of Netanyahu, you know, sitting in a Bedouin tent and visiting Arabs and drinking coffee with them, you know, this reminds me of the older leaders of the Labour Party who used to visit the Nazareth and meet with the Mukhtars and the heads of the Arab community back then. A picture with the Arab dignitaries and Arab personalities was very important to attract the votes of the Arabs. So at least what is good about this image of Netanyahu visiting is that visiting Arabs and sitting with them is that he's trying to remove that image that he had, that he's a racist, that he's against the Arabs, that and the damage that was done by the nation state law.
So
in many ways, I do believe that this will bring him some votes at the end of the day.
Gil, I want to ask you, last week you had the opportunity to sit down with Naftali Bennett, who, and the headline that we ran in print of your story, your interview with him was "The Kingmaker Speaks."
You got it? You got what it's about? The headline?
That was the headline, Gil.
Yes, but did you get the what I was hinting at there?
The Kingmaker? He is the Kingmaker.
The King's Speech.
Oh, the King's Speech for the movie,
won
right?
An Oscar for Best Picture.
So why don't we do the Kingmaker Speech?
But it wasn't a speech. The Kingmaker Speaks. I guess no one got it.
I guess we didn't get it. No, it was a great movie. But I did not get it that way. My question though to you is, you know, he is being touted as the Kingmaker, but he very much wants to see himself, like you wrote, as the King. What are those chances of either of those things happening, him being the one to determine the coalition and maybe even him becoming the next prime minister.
Okay, so the chances of him being the kingmaker are very good. The chances of him being the king are not very good. For him to be the kingmaker, what you have to have is the possibility of him getting both political camps to 61. Right now, the polls show neither side. Before that, the polls were showing only the anti-Netanyahu side.
61, obviously, including him on both sides.
Right.
That each side would need him.
Right. So if he gets 12, 13 seats in the polls, they've got to be above 50. So, we don't know yet whether that will happen, but there's a good chance that he can be the one who decides who forms the government.
And this idea that if there is 61 on Netanyahu's side and there is 61 on the other side, that he could then say to the other side, Gideon Sar, Yair Lapid, if you don't make me prime minister, I'm going with Netanyahu, and that they would agree to make him prime minister even if he only has 12, 13 seats? Is that even something to imagine?
If the choice would be between going to another election and letting Netanyahu stay in power for another 4 months while his trial goes on, or letting him go first in a rotation, then Naftali Bennett is banking that that's what they would agree to do. And Yair Lapid even said yesterday in an interview, he said, replacing Netanyahu is more important than me becoming prime minister. Right. People in Gideon Sar's party have also said that. Benny Begin said it on the radio this morning. There's a lot more strategy to going on here that we haven't been told. He's speaking in codes, Bennett. He talked to me about the Coca-Cola recipe that he has that he can't give out. He talked to our head of strategy, Mayan Hoffman, in a interview at the Tel Aviv Salon about how the magician doesn't give out his secrets. In an interview with the Israel Yom, he gave another metaphor a few days ago. All I know is that he has a brilliant strategist named George Birnbaum, go back to the American strategist, who has worked for party leaders in 30-something different countries. And if anyone could think of some brilliant strategy that can help someone win out of nowhere, it's George.
Although sometimes I find that if people are using a lot of codes and a lot of metaphors, then maybe there might not be some brilliant strategy behind there, but this might be the way to cover it up. But we'll have to wait and see what happens on March 23rd. Khaled, I do want to ask you, the upcoming Israeli election is not the only election that's taking place between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. Eventually in May, right, there's supposed to be a Palestinian election, also for parliament and for the legislative council, as well as for eventually the president, right? Which is the first time, as you mentioned earlier, since 2005. Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, is running. There are some other candidates who have thrown their hat into the ring. But before you kind of just give us the quick lowdown, what's also interesting, no one in Israel is talking about it. It's like, it's not even on anyone's election radar. No one's thinking about the Palestinians, what's going to happen, who's going to be there, are we going to make peace, not make peace, settlements, yes, no. It's as if it doesn't exist.
Well, I have news for you.
It exists.
I can't find people in the Palestinian areas who are talking about the Palestinian election. No one really seems to care. That's because many people are very skeptical about it happening. They just don't believe that it's going to happen. People right now are very busy with the coronavirus. There's a very serious and dangerous upsurge in infections. Mahmoud Abbas declared a state of emergency 2 days ago, and the West Bank is now under lockdown. And that's what people are really talking about right now. But let's go back to the election, not to be confused with the Israeli election. Because each time I write a story saying Marwan Barghouti is thinking of running in the election, or Prime Minister Salam Fayyad is, or the former Prime Minister Salam Fayyad is considering forming a new party, people write to me and say, what? Are they allowed to run for the Knesset? Because people are not aware that there is another election that's supposed to take place. Now, Mahmoud Abbas in January finally called general elections. The election for the parliament, which is called the Palestinian Legislative Council, is supposed to take place on May 22. After that, on July 31, they're supposed to have a presidential election. Now, the presidential election will be the first since 2005, when Mahmoud Abbas was elected to succeed Yasser Arafat.
For a 16-year term?
No, he was elected for a four-year term.
Ah, just a four-year term.
Okay. His term in office expired in January 2009. But he used the dispute with Hamas as an excuse to remain in power. In 2006, we had the last Palestinian parliamentary election, which was won by Hamas, a landslide victory of Hamas, and that actually intensified tensions between Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah faction and Hamas. Anyway, why did Mahmoud Abbas, I mean, the big question that many people keep asking, why did Mahmoud Abbas suddenly call these elections? I mean, why now? You know, what made him wake up one morning after 15
Well, maybe years? After four elections in Israel, he felt like he's missing out on some of the fun.
Joe Biden?
Yes. Yes, the answer is Joe Biden. He wants to send a message to the Biden administration that he's doing the right thing.
Even at the risk of losing, he might lose the presidential election. Or that's you're laughing because that's not going to happen.
First of all, by the way, I want to correct you. You said that he's running in the election. He hasn't yet announced that he's running in that election, although it's widely believed that, first of all, there will be no elections, and if there are elections, he will run and no one can challenge him.
How old is he again, remind us?
He's now 86 years old, and he just entered his 17th year of his four-year term in office. But he seems to be in good health, by the way, functioning and, you know, no problem chairing all these meetings.
Two packs of cigarettes are okay?
Yeah, yeah. He continues to smoke. Thanks to Israel, he got vaccinated. He and his family.
So just quickly, Khaled, in the end, we'll be after an election here, then we'll move into an election there. Do you anticipate change? And we'll do this a little closer to the Palestinian election to get a deeper dive. But just now for our listeners, do you anticipate a change on the Palestinian side?
The question is, what will happen in the parliamentary election if it takes place? Of course, will Hamas win again, or will all these independent candidates who are challenging Fatah, Abbas's ruling faction, will they win? That's the key issue over here, because whoever wins the parliamentary election will be part of the coalition, and that will have an impact on the presidential election later.
Right.
Because the president will have to face a parliament that is dominated by his political rivals, and that's a big problem. This could bring us back, by the way, to the same scenario we were in 2006 when Hamas won the parliamentary election. And that triggered a crisis between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. And look where we are now.
Right.
So all eyes are set on the Palestinian parliamentary election and what's going to happen over
May 22nd then. We
May
will
22nd.
Wait. But Gil, so just quickly to wrap us up on this part, the in Israel, and you've covered 10 national elections, you told me last week, no one is talking about the Palestinians. We used to have elections about the Palestinians, right? The general elections in Israel was yes to a peace deal with the Palestinians and independent state, yes to the disengagement, yes to Olmert's, what was it called, the realignment or convergence plan, right, pulling out of the West Bank unilaterally. Now no one even, it's like it doesn't exist. And it's just Palestinian territories are a 15-minute drive away from where we're sitting right now.
Yaakov, I think you've hit the key that also could help decide this election. I wrote a story a couple weeks ago about how the way to defeat Netanyahu is by out-deceiving him. And I wrote about how Saar and Bennett were out deceiving him, but I left out one component that I have not written yet, which is that Joe Biden also has a role in this. Joe Biden has purposely not gotten involved. Now, all of his predecessors got involved in Israeli elections, so over the last 30 years. Why has he not gotten involved? The answer is he has. By not getting involved, he has made Israelis feel that he won't be involved over the next 4 years. And chances are he will be. The Palestinian issue is going to be a big issue over the next 4 years. And if Joe Biden would reveal that right now, Netanyahu would be helped tremendously. People would think, oh, we need him to protect us. And not as bad as it was with Obama, but still, we need a strong leader, somebody who knows how to say no to the world, which is what Netanyahu knows how to do. Yair Lapid, obviously others don't as much. If Biden was out there giving speeches right now, this is my Middle East peace plan, you're going to have to give up this, this, and that.
That would give Netanyahu a boost in the election. So basically, if by not getting involved, he's actually getting involved, so he's going to stay not involved to remain involved.
Correct.
Somehow that makes sense.
Exactly.
Okay. Gil, you're sticking with me for a quick check-in with David Fine, founder of AngloVision. Now, Gil, you sparked a bit of a controversy a few weeks ago when you wrote in our newspaper that the parties that are running in the Knesset skipped over the Anglo vote. We received op-eds from a bunch of those parties trying to prove you and our newspaper wrong. Yesh Atid, Blue and White, Yamina, and more. And David, you have been pushing the idea that there are about 300,000 to 400,000 Anglos in Israel who you believe could potentially vote as a bloc, maybe similar to the way the Russian Aliyah was when they came to Israel, a million Russian or former Soviet Union, and became Israelis back in the late 90s or in the late 80s or the early 90s. Is that really the case, David? Do you really think that so many Anglos could coalesce together and vote that way?
Well, a lot of people have been doubting us. I don't know about 300,000 to 400,000, but I think that a great number of them can coalesce. We've been running the Anglo Vision for a little over a year now, and we've heard from literally thousands and thousands of Anglos that they believe that we should coalesce. We did an extensive poll, the first ever poll of Anglo voting patterns and ideas that they want to see happen in the country. And many of them, most of the people polled thought that the community can call that. So it's not proven. There are many doubters, but I believe strongly that it could happen.
And so, Gil, tell us, you know, from your experience, just what are the issues that would even bring Anglos together, if possible?
Right now, the coronavirus has really exacerbated the problems that Anglos face when we've seen how the airport being closed caused so many problems for so many families, people that wanted to come to Israel in order to see their parents before they died and were prevented from coming. You had an exceptions committee that required forms in Hebrew that were completely incomprehensible, and people had no one to turn to. People think that only Russian immigrants, Ethiopians, have problems, when the truth is that people that move to this country from anywhere around the world would have problems. Only Anglos have more problems because no one really believes that they have problems.
Right, but you see, I got to say, and David, I'd like your input. You know, I've been living in Israel for 27 years, like Gil from Chicago. I don't think the Anglos are one voice, you know. So, yes, the Russians, you look at Yisrael Beiteinu, Avigdor Lieberman has built in, what is it, Gil, 5 to 6 seats? No matter what, those are people who are going to go with him because that's the Russian vote. The Anglos, you have Anglos in Herzliya and Tel Aviv, completely secular, might lean left. You have Anglos who are out in West Bank settlements who are leaning completely to the right. You got Anglos who are moderately religious and more religious. I mean, it's all over the map, right? Why, David, would Anglos come together?
So you're certainly correct that there are Anglos on both extremes, but a great number of them are in the middle. And they may not agree about the hot button issues, you know, religion and state and the Arab-Israeli conflicts. But we believe that there are issues such as the reform of the governmental system, of creating a more representative government, other things as well, helping Aliyah, helping Klita. We believe that these issues can join many of the people that are in the center.
Now, what would you like to see, though? Would you like to see better representation or more prominent representation in the existing parties? Or would you maybe in your vision, the Anglo vision, like to see a Anglo party led by prominent Anglos, maybe Gil Hoffman as an example, or Yaakov Katz?
Gil Hoffman would be a great leader. But for right now, I think creating a party of our own is a little bit too far of a reach. You know, these one issue or one population parties have not necessarily always succeeded in the past. So right now, we'd like to see representation in the current existing parties. We sent a letter to every party leader a few months ago asking them to put an Anglo in a realistic spot on their party list. And unfortunately, we didn't really see that happen.
Right, Gil, so that's what you wrote about, how it didn't happen. But, yeah, I mean, Yamina has our friend, Jeremy Sultan, and Naftali Bennett himself, who's an Anglo. Yesh Atid has someone in the 21st slot, right? You know, you could say more or less, Blue and White has, what's his name?
Alone Tom, number 10.
Nothing, not serious enough.
None of those count, Jacob. Not one of them. because Jeremy Salton was more disappointed than anybody else about being number 16 on the list. He thought that he deserved to be higher. You've got a French immigrant at number 10 on that list who's going to be a member of Knesset without having to rely on a Norwegian law to get in. Gidon Saar talked big and then didn't include an Anglo in the serious place.
Well, what's her name? Sorry, I forget her name.
Okay, so he's a Canadian. Sharon Haskell, an Anglo. I made her into an Anglo. When she got elected to the Knesset the first time, I said, oh, I see you were born in Canada. You're Canadian. She said, no, I'm not. I don't care about Canada. I don't know anything. And then the more she stayed in the Knesset, the more she realized, wait a second, maybe I am Canadian. And they started sending her around the world, and she started hearing about the problems that there were. And because she was all there was at the time, people turned to her, and she became the representative of Anglos. But that's not what she's there to be, and she intends to be a cabinet minister, which is exactly why Naftali Bennett being an Anglo, and he is, doesn't help. Because he's number one on the list.
Right.
He's going to, you know, make peace in the Middle East or make war on Iran or whatever he's going to do, save Israel from Corona. We need there to be a regular rank and file member of Knesset who makes us a priority so that when we have problems, we can turn to them.
David, give me an example really quickly of an Anglo MK who you think is just a good model of what you'd like to see happen.
I think the fact that Michal Keller-Wundt was not picked to be on any list, she has been, I think, exemplary in terms of representing Anglo needs and Anglo ideas and bringing a breath of fresh air to the Knesset. And again, the fact that she wasn't chosen, I think, says a lot. I think there's one other important point, and that is we don't want someone just because they're an Anglo or just because they speak English. That's important, but we want somebody who's going to bring new ideas to the table and ideas from where we came from that are perhaps new for many, many Israelis.
Right.
I think Michal is a good model.
Anyway, so just, Gil, under your definition of Anglo, is Bibi Netanyahu an Anglo?
The answer is...
Educated in Philadelphia High School, right? Went to MIT, lived in America, was worked in furniture and consulting, married to an American woman at some point. Is he Anglo?
Yes, but that helps Israel as a whole. It helps Israel having a leader who can talk to the world, who understands the world. Maybe some say understands the world as it used to be when the Republicans were in power. Maybe doesn't understand certain things, doesn't understand the way America has changed. But that only goes so far. If you want to have a person who's there fighting for you, representing you, that's not the Prime Minister of Israel, with all due respect.
Understood. David Fine, founder of Anglovision, thank you so much for joining us. And Gil Hoffman, our political analyst, always a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
It's now great to welcome back Lahav Harkov, the Jerusalem Post diplomatic correspondent, who did a great, fascinating, exciting interview this week with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, besides for talking about a lot of different issues, from Biden to Trump to the conversion crisis and controversy, bashing Lapid, Bennett, Gideon Saar, and everyone else who's trying to run against him, and talking a bit about maybe some ambition one day to be a pilot, right, which you'll have to listen to the interview to understand what I'm talking about. But Lahav, I'd like to hear from you, just your sense before we listen to it. What's he like? How did he seem to you? Was he tired? Was he alive? Is he as embattled and under pressure as people are making him out to be? What was your impression spending time with him at the official Prime Minister's residence?
So at this point, I've been on quite a few flights and trips with Prime Minister Netanyahu and his, entourage. So I have a lot to compare it to, and I've also seen him in the Knesset quite a lot over the years that I reported in the Knesset. And he actually seemed not stressed, not under a lot of pressure. We had a couple of minutes sort of to chat before the cameras went on, and he sort of remembered a conversation that he and I had years ago. Asked me if I'd had children since then, which I have. That was interesting because, he's not known to be such a great person at making small talk, but he actually was very friendly in that way before the interview.
Small talk, and he was playing it cool, right?
Yeah. My normal sort of interactions with him in reporting, he's usually much more like in a rush kind of thing. So he actually was kind of relatively relaxed, which is interesting. Afterwards, when I sort of watched the video again and I wasn't in the moment, he looked kind of tired to me. He seemed a little tired. But he didn't seem, not in the moment and not later when I watched it. He didn't, you know, people are saying like, oh, Netanyahu's really stressed. It's almost the election. He's not doing well. He might be, but he was able to play it off like he wasn't at all.
Right. Well, we look forward to, we're going to listen to it now. Great. Thanks a lot, Lahav. And here is the interview Lahav Harkov did with Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister.
Welcome to this Tel Aviv International Salon event. I'm Lahav Harkov, diplomatic reporter for the Jerusalem Post on behalf of the Salon. And we're happy to have you here for the first time.
Thank you.
This is a very exciting week. Everything's opening up, you know, after the post-corona restrictions. But there's one question that I get from the Olim community all the time. Young families, they want to know when they can visit their parents and their parents can come visit them. Right now, I know only Georgia accepts the green passport.
Well, look, I think Israel is coming out in a remarkable way with the green passport ahead of any other country in the world. And we're going to have mutual exchanges with countries. We already have several countries coming here. We're going to exchange green passports. So if I think that's coming very soon. But within a few weeks, we're going to finish inoculating the whole adult population of Israel. And we'll have reciprocal arrangements with the United States. So I hope it's soon. It's a great thing. Israel is leading the world in vaccines. Israel is leading the world in coming out of the economy. And I personally intend to devote myself this year to the economy so that we are not merely the world champions of vaccines, vaccination nation. We're also going to be the world champions in having the fastest growing economy, which includes tourism and air travel.
Well, so your economic stimulus plan has not been able to pass in the current government makeup. Is there anything that could be done in the interim? Because it'll take several months before there's a new government.
Well, the minute I form the next government, the first decision that I make will be to pass the remaining economic stimulus. In addition to 100 billion shekels that we put forward, and Israel's economy is in good shape, we still have a task to revive the rest of the economy. And the real question that we have in the next 2 weeks, the first day that I'll form the next government, I'll bring another 15 billion. But beyond that, I have plans to revive the economy the way I did that in 2003 as finance minister, got Israel out of a crisis into a tremendous revival, and again in a global economic slowdown in 2009, got Israel out with the highest ratings of the credit agencies in the world, the best that we had ever. I've done that, and I'll do it again. And you have to ask the question, in 2 weeks' time, you have to put someone in charge to revive the Israeli economy. Who are you going to do it? Somebody who's already done it successfully and brought Israel's economy to the best possible results in our history, the best results in our history, was someone like Yair Lapid, who told me in a television interview, I don't understand anything about the economy. And it's true. He didn't understand anything. He was the worst finance minister in Israel's history. So you have a plane that you have to fly. And you're the passenger. Who are you going to let pilot the plane? The guy who's experienced, who's got proven results, who's world recognized throughout the world as having made this economic miracle for Israel? Or somebody who doesn't know how to fly the plane? So the plane either doesn't take off or it crashes. It's either me or Lapid, with his strange co-pilots. This is the decision, and I think that people understand that to revive Israel's economy, you need a pair of safe hands, experienced hands, a real pilot. It's me. It's not him.
Well, you've really been a champion of the free market through your whole career, but you know, there's still a lot of things in Israel that are controlled by interest groups and lobbies. And food, for example, is extremely expensive. The dairy in Israel is very expensive. Honey, there's all these things. How can you know? And you've been prime minister now for 11 consecutive years, and those problems still stand. What will you do that's different to lower the cost of living in Israel?
A few years ago, I brought the head of the OECD. That's the organization really of developed economies. I turned Israel from a developing economy into one of the world's most advanced developed economies. But I wasn't satisfied with that. I brought the OECD guy into the cabinet, and I said, tell him. And he said, well, you've done great things under the prime minister. You've lowered tax rates. You've reduced the public sector. You've energized the private sector. But you still have a lot of regulation. I said, well, tell him where we are. We were 6 years ago We were in the last place in the OECD, except Turkey, which was behind us. I formed a government committee. Every 2 weeks, I or the Director General of the Prime Minister's office chopped with a machete regulations. We moved 18 places, more than any other country in the world, in deregulating. But that's not enough for me. I'll do it. I want to bring us into the top 10. Now, who will do this? Who understands this? Yair Lapid, who understands nothing about the economy. Gideon Saar, who never led the economy. Bennett himself never led the economy on anything. I've done enormous results. I will deregulate because it's in my blood. I love chopping the bureaucracy. I just love to do it. It's not merely that it's good for the country. It's good for me. I like it. So I will do it. They're just yakking away. They talk, talk, talk. They do nothing. But we brought Israel to have, right now, to be in the position that we're emerging from the corona with the strongest, virtually the strongest economy in the world. The shekel is at 12-year high. Our credit ratings are at an all-time high. We still have a job to do. And I'll tell you what the biggest problem will be. The biggest problem will be, I will get the economy launched, for sure. They won't. They don't know how to do it. But there's another factor. The economy could tank again. If we don't bring tens of millions of new vaccines, if we don't do that, then we'll go back to Segel, to lockdowns and so on. I'm working right now with Pfizer and Moderna to bring tens of millions of new vaccines, and I'm working to create plants, a plant to produce vaccines here.
Sorry, I wanted to know about that.
Now, who's going to do that? Is Yair who? 180 prime ministers and presidents call Pfizer, call Moderna. They don't take the calls. They took my call. And I persuaded them that Israel will be the model of success for vaccines. And lo and behold, that's happening. But who will continue to do that? Not Lapid, not Bennett, not Gideon. They just don't have it. I have it. And I will bring the economy up. And I think all the Anglos who are here, I want to say, first of all, thank you for supporting, thank you for coming to Israel and being part of the Israeli miracle. But also thank you for giving me the support to bring a free market economy and to bring the Israeli economy to greater heights. And look, I can do it. They can. It's true.
Well, so we're talking about Anglos. Many of us are from the United States and are sort of watching the U.S.-Israel relationship with some concern. I think, the current U.S. administration is full of Obama administration alumni with whom you clashed pretty badly 6 years ago. Is this going to be an obstacle, especially in dealing with the Iranian threat?
Well, first of all, let me say that President Biden, Joe, and I have had a very close relationship for close to 40 years. And I'm not just saying that. It's real. He delivered a wonderful eulogy for my father. I spoke to him after the tragic death of his son, Bo. We have a close relationship, and that's important for the country. But beyond that, I have a close relationship with the American public. I know them very well. I spent some formative years in America, and they know me very well. And they respect me. Many of them respect me a lot, and some of them disagree with me, but that happens in the mishpocha. So that can happen. But when I deal with the United States, our indispensable ally, under changing administrations, I always remember one thing. I represent the state of Israel. I don't represent Republican interests. I don't represent Democratic interests. I represent Israeli interests. And when I need to take a stand for something that I think is important for Israel's survival and security, I don't hesitate to do it under any administration.
But you embraced former President Trump very strongly, and he's a hugely divisive figure in the U.S. during and now after his presidency. Do you regret that level of embrace at all?
No, I think what we did with recognizing the Golan under Israel's sovereignty, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, moving the embassy here, getting out of this dangerous Iran deal, I think these are great things. And I embraced it because that's my policy. When an American administration does things that are good for Israel, then I definitely embrace those policies. But that's what guides me. Policy guides me. The interests of Israel's guide me. And I'm sure that if there's anyone who can assure that Israel's interests are protected in the world and in the United States, it's me. What standing do these people have there? Look, again, can they fly the plane? No, the answer is no, they can't. And if there are pressures that come against us, and that could happen, I don't deny that. There could be pressures on on Judea Samaria, on our Jewish communities there. You need someone who's strong, who can stand up for our interests. And I believe that everybody knows in the Anglo community, they know better than anyone else that I can do what others cannot do.
Well, when we talk about the Iran issue, Iran is now closer to a bomb than it was until 2015. And there's a little bit of a sense of deja vu of Israel's sort of strategy in countering it. Why do you think it'll work this time?
I think if it weren't for the effort that I led worldwide, including going to the American Congress and standing up against this Iran deal, Iran would already have a nuclear, not a nuclear bomb, an arsenal of nuclear bombs. And the political leadership that I put in front of the whole world, the six leading powers in the world were supporting this, and I opposed it. The actions that we took, including sending the Mossad into the heart of Tehran and yanking away their secret atomic archive with 100,000 documents that showed that they're pursuing the nuclear weapons under different guises, and many other activities that I won't itemize, that I authorized personally. Without that, Iran would already have had a nuclear arsenal. And in fact, the only one who's going to continue that resistance and lead it, and by the way, with other Arab countries that I form now, peace deals, and some of them are en route to have new peace deals, one of the things that unites them is they say, we respect your leadership, Prime Minister Netanyahu. We know that you stand against Iran, and that's why we're coming and standing with you. That's different. Who will do this? Yair Lapid, who said that my speech in Congress was a terrible blow to Israel's security interests? This is the man who will stop Iran? Or the others who have no standing at all? You need a world, a leader with a world standing to resist the ongoing attempts of Iran to arm itself with nuclear weapons. Because of what I did, Iran has been set back for years. And because of what I will do, they will never, ever have a nuclear weapon. As long as I'm prime minister, Iran will not have atomic bombs.
There's talk now about some kind of alliance or stronger defense relationship with the UAE, Bahrain, and even Saudi Arabia against Iran. Is there anything you could tell us about that?
Well, I can say that there is a realignment in the Middle East, and I think you should know that when I gave that speech in the UN, that Yair Lapid, who wants to be prime minister, who will be prime minister if the Anglos don't come out and vote for me, he'll be the prime minister. You're going to get Yair Lapid as the prime minister, along with, rotating, strange rotation with Bennett and Gideon. They're already fighting who'll sit on the chair. They can't fly the plane. They just want to sit in the cockpit and be photographed. They have no idea how to fly the plane. So when I gave that speech that Yair Lapid criticized, during the speech, in literally live transmission, we got calls from leaders, Arab leaders in the Middle East, who said, we can't believe what your prime minister is doing right now. He's standing up against the whole world, against the U.S. at the time. And he's lifting the torch of resistance against Iran's nuclear program. You know, that is big. That's really what did the pivot. That's what made them come to Israel. That's what forged the four historic peace agreements that we have today. Because they saw Israel not merely as a source of technology for everything, that clean energy, high tech, water, and so on. They saw Israel as standing up against Iran, which threatens them the way it threatens us, and threatens us more with destruction. But they understood that. So Israel became an indispensable ally. But Israel under whom? Yair Lapid? Guido, Ben, they can't fly the plane. They cannot protect Israel.
What was
but
it?
I can, and I have, and I will.
What was it like meeting with MBS?
What's it like asking questions that you know you won't get an answer?
I had to try it. All right. Well, I think a lot of Olim are interested to hear what you think about this new Supreme Court decision allowing reform and conservative conversions to be recognized for purposes of Aliyah.
Well, I think we should draw a distinction. I think we have to protect the Chok HaShvut. I think that's important. I'm very liberal on conversions because I'm the prime minister, the only prime minister that enabled reforms and conversions in the army. And now with the Nassim report, I'm very much very favorable to it, will probably adopt something, either the report or something like it. So I have no hesitation about that. But I think we have to be very careful, very, very careful about tampering with the law of return, because the law of return gives us the envelope of protection, making sure that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. You have allowed any reform person, reform, conservative, Israel is their home. It's not an issue. And people can do this and they can come here and that's fine. The real question we have to protect is to prevent fake conversions that could enter the country. And then, you know, a lot of people want to come into Israel. Mm-hmm. In fact, I put up a fence, you know, they call it a wall. But I prevented the overrunning of Israel, which is the first world country that you can walk to. The only first world country that you can walk to from Africa. We would have had here already 1 million illegal migrants from Africa, and the Jewish state would have collapsed. The Jewish state, conservative, reform, orthodox, would have collapsed.
So I want to put a finer point.
So I stopped it. You know how many people...
Your concern is African migrants want to convert to Judaism in order to get
citizenship? Not only from there, you could have it from the entire world. I think we can solve the problem of conversion for all streams and all denominations in Judaism, but we also have to protect the borders of Israel so that we're not overrun. And I think we can find a balance between the two. That's what I intend to do. Mm-hmm. I've done it, because without the security barrier that I built, or rather the physical barrier that I built across the Sinai, we would have had today 1 million illegal migrants from Africa. I saw the country, the cities of Israel being overflooded. I was in Eilat. A mother was crying to me. She said, I can't send my daughter out. You know, I saw this in Tel Aviv. I saw this filling out everywhere. And I stopped it. By the way, the bureaucracy was dead against it. They said it won't work. And I said, it will work. Build the fence. I went there every 3 months. I can fly the plane. I can protect Israel. I have, you know what we say this Anglo-Saxon word, kabbalot, it's called,
receipts,
I have a record.
You have receipts.
Results, I have receipts, I have results. And they don't have it. They're full of ambition, but they have no record, they have no experience, they have no capacity, no proven ability. And now we have to fly the Israeli plane.
Well, you know, both
okay,
the,
who'll fly the plane?
Both the conversion issue and the migrants issue brings me to the issue of the Supreme Court. A lot of people in your party and in your bloc want to make serious reforms. They want to pass a bill to override certain Supreme Court decisions. Do you support that law or that proposal?
I think we need judicial reform. I think that's everybody understands that there's been an imbalance. The great thing about democracies, and I'm a big Democrat with a small D. I'm not a Democrat or Republican. But the big thing about democracies is they have a balance between the three branches of government. And I think sometimes we lost the balance in Israel. Ultimately, you know, each one balances the other. And if you look at where the real, if you have to give an extra edge to someone, it's the parliament, because it represents the Knesset. It represents the will of the people. And I think that in many ways we've lost that balance. We'll have to restore it with judicial reform, 100%.
But, you know, another important part of democracy is rule of law. And you've been very sharply critical of the Attorney General, of the judiciary at large. You've said that your specific cases are, you know, fake, basically, and that they're just a political attempt to overthrow you. You don't have a concern that this is undermining the rule of law in Israel?
No, I think what undermines the rule of law is that when the prosecutions are used, Justice Jackson, one of the great American jurists, said, it's when prosecution uses rules or creates rules. In my case, they actually created a new crime. They created a crime that doesn't exist in the rule books of the United States or any other democracy in the last 244 years, when they had fake, basically a fake witch hunt with fake charges, with blackmailing witnesses. Unbelievable. Erasing documents, creating new crimes. This is ridiculous. I mean, the whole thing is just collapsing under our face. But it's not only in my case. I heard the same, you know, I heard the idea that people are being blackmailed from this, what do you call them, the law and order gang, supposedly. This was, I heard this from the president of Israel, I heard it from Professor Friedman, who was the justice minister. I've heard it from so many others. I heard it actually, believe it or not, from the attorney general himself when he was being charged. So I don't think this is new. I think everybody understands there has to be a reform. The rule of law is protected when people don't do witch hunts, when they don't try to bring down a strong right-wing prime minister with judicial means. They can't beat me in the polls, so they use these absurd charges that will collapse and are collapsing in front of our eyes.
Let's talk about politics. You're campaigning very hard in the Israeli-Arab sector. Mm. They've been here all the time. Well, where were you in past elections?
I've been here all the time. You just didn't notice. From the year 2010, when I a year after I became prime minister a second time, until now, that's 11 years, I put in 21 billion shekels for the Arab sector. Nobody noticed. For infrastructure, for education, for welfare, for sewage, for roads, for transportation inside the communities. Nobody noticed, but they noticed. The other thing that I did was I built 9 police stations. We had only one in the Arab communities. 9 police stations in the Arab communities. Because they deserve law and order, real law and order, the way all of us do. And I made 4 historic peace deals with Arab countries. I did this for all our citizens. And the Arab citizens understand that. They understand that all these other Arab parties were taking them to a radical cul-de-sac, a place, irrelevance, basically. They didn't deliver on their promises, but we are. And I have a vision, which is really a classic liberal vision in the traditional sense of the world, that this country, every citizen in this country, every child in this country, every girl and boy should have an equal opportunity. Equal opportunity in education, equal opportunity in having a safe environment, equal opportunity to open up a business, to get credit. And that's what I'm doing. I'm changing it because it's a battle between modernity and medievalism. The Islamists want to take us back. Well, and the modernists like me want to take us forward. And I want them to be involved. And you know what they're coming to? They're coming to Likud because they understand that what I said is true. And this is my vision. I like to see what I see in Dubai and what I see in Abu Dhabi in the Arab communities here. You think that's impossible? I think it's possible. Well, it's going to happen. It's happening in the Jewish parts. Why can't it happen in the Arab parts?
Apropos having Israeli-Arab citizens feel safe, your coalition, if you build the next coalition, looks like it will be reliant on Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has a racial agenda and is anti-Arab. And you've said he's not going to be a minister in your government, but you might be reliant on him for the 61st vote. How do you reconcile these things?
Because we'll get a lot more. Because if the Anglos who listen to me now and the other people who support the right, there's a very strong right-wing majority in Israel. There's a right majority of at least 70, some say as much as 80. And basically what the mainstream media is trying to do is try to get us to sleep or try to divide us so that we don't have the strong right-wing government under me, strong with one head and not with 3 heads competing with each other. We have that possibility right now. If people come and vote, then we're going to get a lot more than 61, and I'm sure that we can do it.
But if you sit at home,
you're going to get Lapid with Merav Michaeli, who said you shouldn't go to the army, with this woman who said you shouldn't rise in the time of the Tzfira for the Yom HaShoah. And you're going to get a Meretz government, and you're certainly going to have the whole reliance on the Mishutefet, on the Arab list. That's crazy.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a couple questions from the Olim community. Victor wants to know what we're doing to get Israel to zero carbon emissions and to deal with the climate change.
Israel is leading the world right now in reducing the dependence on coal. Within a few years, we're going to be completely free of coal. We're putting solar energy in big time. Putting also natural gas, that is important. It's a lot cleaner than coal. And I think that you can see today that I got the natural gas out of the seabed. My political opponents refuse to do that. We're getting 3 billion shekels this year from this natural gas in the sea. Next year, 5 billion shekels into our economy. That's going to be part of the economic growth that we're bringing. So it's a cleaner and more prosperous Israel that I'm bringing.
Okay, and Mickey asks, your political bloc is dependent on the Haredi ultra-Orthodox parties, and she wants to know what will be done to have sort of more equal treatment, whether it's the enforcement of coronavirus rules or long-term enlistment in the IDF.
I think that everybody should recognize that we are advancing a government that is important for, that is working for all of Israel's citizens. I, for one, object to the idea of this attempt to constantly divide and attack one part of the population against the rest. They're part of us. They're moving with us. They're changing. They're joining the workforce in record numbers, because of my free market approach and the reduction over time of the dependence on the government. I think what is happening is the Haredi community is joining modernity. That's the right thing to do. And by the way, the other parties are sending feelers to all the Haredi parties, so they're just lying through their teeth. But the real thing is to have the Haredi community, the Arab community, integrate into this tremendous success story, this miracle that is the State of Israel. And the miracle is based on the free market reforms that I've put in and will continue to put in and draw everyone in. That's the real solution to our future.
So now a fun question. A lot of people wanted to know what you like to do to unwind, what books you're reading, what TV shows you watch.
Wow. Well, first of all, I read a lot of books. I mean, I really read a lot of books. That's not only a haven and an escape, that's the way to recharge your intellectual batteries. Kissinger said, once you enter public life, you deplete your intellectual capital. I found exactly opposite. I read many, many books. I mean, like, a lot. And usually history, biography. Dan Rather, the famous the television personality in the United States, brought his grandson here. Grandson was in Brown. He said, I'd like to go into politics. What should I study? And I said, three subjects. History, history, history.
Not architecture?
That helps. I'm an architect of other things, but no, history first. And so I read a lot of history books. And the other thing is I also watch some interesting soap operas. The Crown.
That's big news this week.
Yeah.
All right, so a final question as we're running out of time. As Israel's longest-serving prime minister, what do you think your legacy will be?
Well, I think that two things. One, the protector of Israel, because I have devoted much of my adult life to preventing Iran from having nuclear weapons. And you have to ask that question. If Iran has atomic bombs and it has a specific publicly stated goal to destroy the State of Israel, every one of us, left, right, Arab, Jew, they want to destroy, they want to wipe us off the map. I've devoted my life so far successfully to preventing them from being able to do that. And as long as I'm prime minister, they'll never be able to do that. So that's my legacy, the protector of Israel. And the second thing, the liberator of its economy. Because I've introduced a free market economy. All the others are just yakking away. They tweet, they talk. They haven't a clue how to do it. But I've done it. I went to a very good business school at MIT, and then I went to the best place that I could learn about liberating economies, the Boston Consulting Group, which is like the Sayeret Matkal of all these consulting groups. And I learned there, and I had a great teacher there. His name was Bruce Henderson, a Virginian. He was 75 years old. He called me into his office on the first day, and he said, and I was 27 years old, he said, you know, I know you're going to go back to your country. You won't be here long. But study and listen everything you can gain here, because one day it will help your country's economy. I thought he was stark raving mad, but he was absolutely right. And I'm so proud of the dozens and dozens of reforms that we've made, launching Israel to be one of the great advanced economies of the world, and you ain't seen nothing yet. I'm going to bring 5G, robotics, biology, life sciences, clean energy, cyber, turned Israel into a cyber power, a gas power. The sky's the limit. I'm going to do this, and I'll tell you one thing else. Billions and billions of dollars that are coming in from the peace treaties that I brought in that nobody believed I would bring in under peace for peace, not peace for tearing away Jews from their homes. This is going to make Israel a great, great country, one of the greatest economies in the world. So the protector of Israel, the liberator of its economy, that's enough.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. See you next week at the Jerusalem Post podcast.